Our first case this morning is number 06-1955 and 2357, Laborers' Pension Fund against the Pavement Maintenance Incorporated. Mr. Pennelly.
Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, my name is Anthony Pennelly, and I represent Matt Leasing. Your Honor, these are consolidated appeals from two orders entered before Judge Zagel, requiring my client to turn over an amount of money, which was considered to be an asset of Pavement Maintenance Company. The parties were linked together in the underlying facts through the performance of some construction contracts. Pavement Maintenance was a subcontractor for my client and did perform some pavement installation work for Matt Leasing, which is a general contractor. The issues, as I believe they are framed before Your Honor by the parties, initially the first issue, back to the entry of the order here, deals with the applicability of Illinois Supreme Court Rule 277F, and at this stage the applicability of it as raised by Matt Leasing before this court. As noted in the briefs, there was no briefing of this issue, or it was not raised before the trial court. It is raised here on appeal in Matt Leasing's brief. And with respect to that, Your Honor, it would be our position that under Rule 69, adopting the procedures and policies of Illinois, a court in conducting a supplemental proceeding would follow the Illinois law. I saw the language from Judge Posner in the Ruggiero case indicating, of course, that a district court judge still retains full discretion and can apply the rules in whatever manner seems appropriate in terms of resolving the case. But the Illinois Supreme Court rule and the case law applying that rule are noted by the parties in a number of different cases in which this issue was raised on appeal.
But, Mr. Pennelly, I didn't find a single case that characterized Rule 277F as fundamentally jurisdictional in the sense of going to the subject matter jurisdiction, even of an Illinois court, far less of a federal court. And, in fact, I'm not aware of any situation in which the federal court's jurisdiction is determined by a state rule of procedure. The federal court had jurisdiction over this case to begin with because it was an ERISA case. There's ancillary, or if you will, supplemental jurisdiction over the collection proceeding. And then the rules of procedure for the collection proceeding are dictated by state law, in this case, Illinois law.
Judge, I don't mean to characterize this as a rule which would spring from a statute and be determined to be a subject matter jurisdictional rule.
Well, if it's not a subject matter jurisdiction rule, then why isn't your failure to call it to the attention of the district court fatal, really? I mean, the district, you were litigating before the district court. You were both before and after this six-month deadline. You were filing motions. You were agreeing to things. You were asking for more time. The district court proceeds with the case. I don't see how you can do all that and then turn around on appeal and say, oh, well, even though we never mentioned it to the district court, in fact, the court should have stopped proceedings at that six-month point.
Judge, I would say, first of all, that we never asked for an extension of any time or continuance on behalf of Matt Leasing. The record doesn't reflect that we asked to continue the proceedings.
Well, you might not use the word continuance, but you were not producing material. You were not speeding this proceeding along, I'll put it that way.
Well, Judge, the initial date, I believe, is the date that my client appears for his citation, which was in December of 2004, which he did. And we were asked to produce some additional materials after that, which we did in January. And the court eventually set a date in July for the hearing of this, but I don't mean to
indicate. I thought, for example, on April 28, 2005, the district court enters a motion for turnover of assets and continues that because Matt Leasing requested time to file a responsive pleading. That's in docket number 46. court gives you more time, court gives Matt Leasing until May 5 to respond, schedules a status hearing for May 9, then all parties agree on May 9 that the proceedings will be continued to May 31st and so on. I mean, there's a sense of ongoing litigation here that I get. Nothing to tell the district court, well, you know, on June 13, this all grinds to a halt.
And I would say to you, Judge, that there was nothing to say that to the district court. I agree, certainly, with that proposition.
And what about the evidentiary hearing in which you participate on September 7th, which is well after that June 13 date? You think you can really show up and not tell the district court that there's a problem?
No, I don't. If I was aware of a problem and I brought it to the district court's attention, or whether or not I did not. There's no record. No one said it to Judge Zagel, and I certainly didn't in that circumstance. But the rule, what I'm saying here, is not so much that this is a subject matter jurisdictional, but I may have said it inartfully, but I think I did say it in here, that what happens is it says in the rule, but if you don't have a judgment order, an order of the court, or satisfaction of judgment, the proceeding terminates automatically 6 months from the date.
But the Illinois courts have interpreted this in a flexible way. For example, there's an Illinois appellate court case, Levine against Pascal, that says unswerving obedience isn't demanded where there's no material harm done to anyone. Other Illinois cases also suggest that were you in an Illinois court, there would be, I would say, the usual rules of forfeiture and questions of prejudice and all the rest of it that we would follow, too, in federal court.
But in every one of those cases, including Levine, there is some indication that the Illinois courts declined to apply this rule in two circumstances, as I read them. One, in which the respondent delays the proceedings by not providing materials or appearing for an examination and then claims that the filing of an appearance triggers the six-month date. Or two, in which there is at least some order. In all of those Illinois cases where there may have been an order entered perhaps longer than the order reflects, the trial court did grant extensions, finding that there were reasons, as listed in the statute, in the interest of justice, to extend the six-month period of time. There is no case that I saw, and I think the Zubak case is contrary, where the court said this issue wasn't raised in the trial court, and there is no order, and you can't raise it on appeal, because in all of those cases, parties that raised the issue raised it in cases in which there had been some extension by the court.
And well, the court, if you're just looking for some perhaps inartfully worded extension, why don't we have that here in the order of May 19, 2004, where the judge says the citations and any third-party citations shall remain in full force and effect pursuant to Rule 277F.
The citation on my client was not served as of May 19, 2004, Your Honor. My client was served in July of 2004. My client was not party in any way to the litigation in May of 2004. My client was served in July of 2004, and so the court may have entered an order at that time, but there was no citation to Matt Leasing issued at that point, nor was my client even aware that the litigation was pending at the time that that order was entered. And so, respectfully, I would say that what the rule provides is that unless there is an extension or unless there is a delay by the parties in terms of producing the initial information, the proceeding terminates. From the standpoint of the district court here, for instance...
But this, of course, is civil litigation. This is not a criminal case where we would find plain error. In civil litigation, the normal rule is things that you don't raise before the lower court are not properly preserved on appeal.
There is no plain error, to my understanding.
No, there's no plain error in this, in the civil context. So I'm just saying, in the civil context, which this case falls in, if you don't raise it somehow before the district court, you forfeit it on appeal.
Well, all I can say, Your Honor, is, as we try to frame the issue, this court has never hesitated to hold in its opinions on the dismissal of lawsuits and the failure of parties to complete a settlement that once a proceeding terminates, the district court loses jurisdiction. And when jurisdiction is lost, the court cannot enter orders, even to enforce the settlements.
But there was no termination of this proceeding. I mean, that's why I'm saying this is, you're trying to go through the back door, make this subject matter jurisdiction, and it isn't. If there is a final judgment in a district court and there's a notice of appeal, jurisdiction transfers to this court. But we don't have time to go into all the nooks and crannies of this doctrine, but the truth is the district court was proceeding on this matter.
Your Honor, if I might move to the second issue that we have. With respect to the turnover order itself, I think the law is clear both in the cases in this district cases in this circuit and the bankruptcy cases which apply it, that a turnover order is appropriately entered for property that is in the possession of the individual. And specifically with respect to some of the issues that were litigated before the district court, my client did testify to provide documentation of and pay fees with the agreement, as testified to by both himself and the company's representative, for trucking, which reduced the amount of money that he owed. And it was not a receivable at the time. It was not an effort to defeat the bank's lien.
I understand that that was his view of the facts, but the district court pretty clearly thinks that the evidence of those transactions is insufficient and makes a finding of fact that that kind of offset isn't proven on this record. And that's something we approach through the lens of clear error, isn't it?
Well, Judge, I think what the district court found was that the $126,000 credit that my client claimed based on the adjustment of the invoices, he was not credible, and he wouldn't credit that. I think the court found as a matter of law that my client could not set off the amount of the trucking bills that it paid.
Well, he also says they are, in fact, two different companies, right?
Yes.
Right. So what's the limit in this, in these kinds of cases with unrelated companies, you know, two separate corporations where you don't have veil piercing or the like? They all just kind of get to go in and say, trust us, we set it all off?
Well, I don't think anyone gets to say that, nor did anyone do that here. I would think the reality of the transactions were this company installed asphalt on the street. It needed to have someone truck the asphalt there, or it couldn't work. So my client provided that, and the company agreed to that.
You know, you're looking through this. There are accounts receivable owed to the pavement company. The pavement company, in turn, had debts to the trucking company. We understand that. But no one has created any set of priorities for that. We did have an order saying that the bank's priority was higher than that of the funds. But for you to sort of short-circuit and say, well, actually, the priority of pavement's debt to the trucking company should, in effect, be superior to the priority under which it had to pay its debt to the bank, doesn't really make any sense. I mean, it had accounts receivable from the MAT leasing.
Well, it had accounts receivable, and it also had accounts payable that MAT leasing agreed to pay on its behalf so that it could do business.
But that's where the district court's findings of fact don't really back you up.
I don't think the court made a finding of fact, with all due respect, Your Honor, on the issue of those bills. It said you can't have a set-off between the related parties as a matter of law.
What he says here, this is at page 5, MAT Leasing also claims to have offset its debt to PMI by making payments to MT. That's the topic we're talking about right now. And he writes both things. He writes what you say and what I'm saying. I do not find that MAT Leasing was entitled to or did offset its indebtedness to PMI in this matter. Then he goes on and talks about separate corporations and different kinds of limitations on that. So, you know, it's really both things, I think.
Well, but the record is certainly without controversy on the fact that both PMI's representative and my client testified to the offsets, that it was a standard practice between them to do it.
But why did the district court have to believe either that it was happening or that the amounts they were recalling without much documentation were correct? What forced the district court to accept that?
Nothing forces the district court, and there's just no contrary evidence, though. There's nothing to the contrary of that fact other than the bank saying you can't do it. There's nothing contrary to what the bank's own witness said, which is, yes, we allowed them to set these amounts off because we needed to have the trucking, because they couldn't. The trucking created the work, which created the receivable. And if you agree that I'm going to reduce your price if you'll pay the trucking for me, as both parties testified to the agreement here, I don't know why that is illegal or unenforceable, Your Honor. I don't see a citation.
There has to be some sort of a record, though. Even when you refer to an offset, that's sort of like a barter in a way. You say, I'll do this, you do that, and we won't have any payments going back and forth. And, you know, you can't do that. That's why there have to be records for receivables and invoices.
Well, I think that that's part of the problem with this entire case is the record keeping on both sides of it.
Well,
very bad, Your Honor. I understand that. I mean, the records are what we gave to the district court. And that's all I can say with respect to them. But the testimony of all of the parties seems to indicate that they reached everything here was done on a handshake or oral agreement. And there just isn't any other record. There are no written contracts to enforce. There's nothing other than their word about this, which they both agreed to and the court disregarded, which I think does rise to the level that this court is something you could look at in terms of that. With respect to the final issue, as I noted here, I believe there is clear error in the calculation of the amounts in that the amounts are taken from supplemental reply brief, which is in quoted in there but is never included in the record, was not filed, is not part of the record in this case. And we did have, at the close of that hearing, the judge saying, I'll give you the opportunity to come back, and I assume that's when we were going to file briefs, when we were going to do things. I did do what the judge said. I spoke with Mr. Walker myself on three occasions. He said, we're going to set something, you'll hear from it, and then I got the order. And I think that if those calculations are reflected in that supplemental brief, it's not part of the record. And thus, the court may have been mistaken in including it, but I think that would be clear error because it's actually evidentiary facts which were never testified to. So with all due respect, Your Honor, relying on the arguments in our briefs, we would ask that you reverse or, in the alternative, reverse and remand this for a recalculation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pennelly. We'll hear now from Mr. Wallace.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Pat Wallace. I represent the Laborers' Pension and Welfare Funds. I'm going to significantly limit my discussion that I prepared in light of what Judge Wood has already questioned counsel about.
Wallace, I do have one kind of practical question. The funds are here litigating away for this $240,000, but is your what's your interest in this? You're litigating right now for the bank, right, given the priority order?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I believe, and I don't have the exact calculations, but I believe that the bank has, in the interim, obtained recovery, and we may stand to benefit from this.
I see. So there might be some, your hope or expectation is some of this will spill over into your debt.
That's correct, Your Honor. On the issue of Illinois Supreme Court Rule 277F, I won't belabor the point. The one thing I did want to mention is that in addition to the discussion that was had, there is no prejudice or harm resulting from the delay. Not only did counsel waive the argument and implicitly agree to the continuations by being present, but there's no harm that's articulated. There's no subsequent lien party, lien holder's rights that are being trampled on. Nor can the defendant argue any harm. Indeed, looking at the documents relied upon in evidence, it seems that these adjustments were made in 2004 and not in 2002, contemporaneous with the work being performed and the invoices being submitted. So it appears as though the defendant, or Matt Leasing, did not even consider this issue until it became embroiled in the citation proceeding. I'll move to the second argument, which is raised, which is that there's no identifiable asset to attach. And obviously I would agree that PMI rendered services to Matt Leasing. There were receivables due. The court found, and I don't think there is clear error, that the invoice adjustments and the set-offs were not proper, both on a factual basis as well as legally. Again, highlighting the fact that if you look at the documents relied on by Matt Leasing, the adjustments were all made off of 2004 invoices. It appears, for example, on the PMI invoice that the adjustments were made on an invoice dated December 2nd, 2004. So none of these adjustments were made contemporaneously They were made arguably after the citation was issued. And so Judge Zagel's point with regard to trying to defeat MB's perfected lien, for that matter, the citation lien, is well taken. I don't believe there is any basis for finding clear error with regard to the court's decision. And the final argument that I wanted to touch upon, again, I'm being brief here in light of the discussion that's already been had, is the conclusion that the judge committed clear error in his calculations. I believe that, not to go into the invoices, I don't want to confuse the issue any further. The parties have briefed it. But Matt concedes in its argument that it adjusted $126,000 of invoices from PMI, credited $112,000 to MT, and then takes an additional $30,000 in monies that were purportedly paid by an entity called T and B to PMI. And if you take those three figures, they total $268,000. So Matt's effort to try to discredit the veracity of the invoice submitted by PMI and relied upon by the district court, I think, falls on its face, because the figures that Matt comes up with exceeds the value of the invoice that Judge Zagel relies on, and that doesn't even include invoice number 743, which would add an additional $57,000 to the total and bring the total over $326,000. So I think, once again, there's no clear error. The judge made factual determinations regarding the invoices, and I believe the district court's decision should be upheld. Unless there are any further questions, I'll turn this matter over to counsel for MB.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Stevens.
If it pleases the court, on behalf of MB Financial Bank, we are the first in line to benefit from what occurred here. I think we've heard the Matt Leasing effectively abandon all the arguments that it's made in the briefs in this case. He concedes that he never presented the argument below. He effectively admits a waiver. He's abandoned the subject matter jurisdictional argument. Rule 277 under Illinois law is certainly not a subject matter jurisdictional rule. Subject matter jurisdiction in Illinois is simply the court has jurisdiction of all justiciable matters, quote unquote. And there's federal ancillary or supplemental jurisdiction here under Peacock versus Thomas and the other cases. So it's not a subject matter jurisdiction rule. What is Rule 277? Well, it's simply a rule of practice. It's like the rule you have to answer interrogatories within 28 days. It's like a statute of limitations or any of those time rules. And those time rules in civil practice can be waived. And they were waived here. They were really waived here because they went to trial and never raised the issue before the district court, saying, Your Honor, you shouldn't be hearing this case now. The 6 months has expired. They just went ahead with the trial. And as creative lawyers, they came up with an argument on appeal. But it can't fly. They tried to make it a subject matter jurisdiction argument in the brief to try to get around the waiver argument. And then effectively, in oral argument, they abandoned the subject matter jurisdictional argument. So end of jurisdictional issue, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can see. On the turnover order, the argument I think has been made that there should not have been an order for turnover of money because somehow money is not a tangible asset. Money is probably the most important asset in our free enterprise system. It is an asset.
And the way I understand his argument, though, it's that because there were these offsets to the trucking company, I'm trying to think of these companies without too many initials because I get confused by that, meant that actually the amount of the receivables itself was lower since the companies had in a sense already settled some accounts as between themselves.
And the district court judge heard the testimony of the witnesses on that and just rejected that. He just didn't believe the witnesses on that. They had nothing to back themselves up. There was nothing but a stamp on a document indicating pay. There was no contemporaneous record. The only record was prepared in contemplation of litigation. And as I pointed out in the red brief for MB Bank at page 29, several cases, that a credibility determination can virtually never be clear error, this court has said on several occasions. So it's a credibility question. There were witnesses on both sides of the issue, and the district judge just didn't believe the witnesses on one side.
What about Mr. Pennelly's argument that the district judge sort of left things hanging in midair, said, you know, talk to each other, come back, and then all of a sudden he rendered the decision based on this brief?
Should have been something brought to the attention of the district judge by Matt Leasing, not to the attention of this court. Should have gone in on a motion and presented that to the district court judge.
Now, do you concede then that the actual numbers in the brief had not been otherwise introduced into the record?
No. I think the numbers were correct. And, in fact, as we pointed out in our brief, I think that we actually gave Matt Leasing about $40,000 more of credits than it otherwise was entitled to. That amount that we should have had a judgment for was actually about $40,000 higher. But what we said in the district court, we will accept and we are bound by. So I don't think that there was anything that the judge did that wasn't before him, that wasn't in the record, that wasn't proven. And if they felt that there was some problem, they should have presented a post-trial motion to the judge to correct that. And that's it, Your Honors, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time does Mr. Pennelly have? You have 3 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I don't know of any requirement that we file a post-trial motion on any matter, particularly with the standard for motions for reconsideration here. And we did not file such a motion because I didn't think it would be granted. With respect to those numbers, what they really do is double bill my client. That $57,000 bill is included in the initial numbers, and then it's included a second time in the supplemental brief. So the number of $293,000 that Judge Zagel started from before he credited my client for some offsets doesn't exist in the record.
Why do you think Judge Zagel would not have been open to an argument that a simple mathematical error like that had been committed? Seems to me that's a perfectly reasonable thing to raise to a district court in a motion for reconsideration.
Judge, perhaps it could have been raised. I didn't raise it there, and I don't know of any requirement that anyone seek reconsideration on that. It's not a matter of a trial error, as you would see in a state criminal proceeding or a proceeding that there is a rule that says you must go back to the district court. There were documents. I really didn't know what happened here. We were going to have an argument and a hearing. We got the order, and we filed notice of appeal in this matter. So I did not bring that back. But the record is quite clear that the judge told us we would get a chance to bring this all together. It didn't happen. As to the other point, it still remains that there are a number of items here. There's another check for $16,000 that the judge did not credit, and I don't know of any reason why. The judge credited only two of the three checks to MT Transit. There's the $30,000 credit where the bank presented an order from the bankruptcy court that said that a corporate officer cashed those checks and stole the money. He personally received it. That can't be money that was in my client's possession on the date of the turnover order. Didn't have it. It was paid to a corporate officer. Whether he gave it to his company or not is not within my client's control. So respectfully, those kind of matters all add up to, I think, some clear error in the total number that was ordered by the court. Thank you for the time this morning, Your Honors.